ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Lehigh University biochemist Michael Behe has published three major volumes questioning the adequacy of evolution to explain life and proposing intelligent design as a better alternative. He's been challenged bitterly by opposing scientists and even politicians. He's even been accused of not answering the challenges. Today, though, Discovery Institute Press releases Michael Behe's latest book, A Mousetrap for Darwin. It's a collection of essays he's written over the years, answering his critics in careful detail. And here we hear Dr. Behe reading the introduction to this new book.
Since the turn of the millennium, a raft of distinguished biologists have written books critically evaluating evolutionary theory. None of them think that Darwin's mechanism is the main driver of life. It may surprise people who get their information about the state of science from gee whiz puff pieces in the mainstream media, but, although strong partisans still hold out, the eclipse of Darwinism in the scientific community is well advanced. A few years ago, the journal Nature published an exchange between two groups of scientists, one defending Darwin and the other saying it's time to move on. It's nice to have defenders, but when an idea has been around for 150 years, wished well by all the right-thinking people, investigated to death by the scientific community, and a piece appears in the world's leading science journal saying it's time to move on, then it's time to move on. The question, of course, is move on to what? Those books by scientists dissing Darwin offer their own clever ideas, but so far the scientific community isn't buying any of them. All the new ideas, self-organization, facilitated variation, symbiosis, complexity theory, and more, are quickly concluded to be non-starters, to have the same problems as Darwin's theory, or both. In the absence of an acceptable replacement, and because of its usefulness as a defensive talking point in fending off skepticism from the public, intellectual inertia maintains Darwinism as textbook orthodoxy. How can Darwin's theory be on the ropes, and yet presidential candidates still be roasted for mealy-mouthed answers about evolution? How can new fossils be paraded monthly across the front pages of major newspapers as fresh and powerful evidence for evolution, but distinguished scientists still argue against the sufficiency of simple random mutation and natural selection? To understand the seeming conundrum, one has to make a critical distinction between evolution itself, call it mere evolution, and the mechanism or cause of evolution. Mere evolution is the bare proposition that organisms living today are descended with modification from organisms that lived in the distant past. There is terrific evidence consistent with that. On the other hand, we can ask, well, what caused such astounding changes to take place? What is the reason or mechanism for evolution? That's the sticking point. Darwin's claim to fame is not that he proposed mere evolution. The idea that modern organisms descended from ancient ones had been discussed by other scientists well before Charles Darwin came on the scene. Those pre-Darwinian scientists, however, all proposed teleological reasons for evolution. That is, reasons above and beyond nature itself, such as a guiding force or some inborn drive to improve. Darwin's claim to fame, rather, was to propose a cause for evolution that involved only mechanical considerations that science could readily study, such as natural selection acting on random mutation. Darwin actually wrote of unspecified random variation because he and all the other scientists of his day were in the dark about the mechanism of heritable change to life, mutations in DNA. Although he wasn't the first to propose it, Darwin popularized the idea of evolution by envisioning it as a wholly mechanized phenomenon that fell fully within the purview of science. Darwin's proffered mechanism of random variation plus selection actually fell out of favor quickly in the 19th century. But the residual notion of mere evolution continued to provide a framework for scientists to classify life, comparing similarities between different organisms, noting differences between similar ones, and building a pattern of relationships. It wasn't until the 1940s, long after the publication of The Origin of Species, when increasing understanding of the genetics of inheritance was seen to be at least compatible with Darwin's mechanism, that scientific leaders met and proclaimed what was dubbed the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, a fusion of Darwin's theory with modern genetics. At that point, Darwin's mechanism became the presumptive explanation in the scientific community and the popular press for the cause of evolution, at least for a few decades. After World War II, new equipment and new techniques allowed biologists to probe ever more deeply into life, until at last they hit its foundation, molecules. From today's perspective, it seems odd, but until remarkably recently in history, scientists had little idea of exactly how life worked or what its underlying basis looked like. The big breakthroughs arguably came in the 1950s with the discovery of the shapes of DNA and myoglobin, a protein that stores oxygen in muscles, as well as the cracking of the genetic code. The structure of myoglobin showed that life's molecules were not built to look pretty, like some New Age crystals. Rather, they were machines, and they were built to do specific, concrete jobs. The genetic code demonstrated that DNA carried information, an unheard-of property for a natural chemical. Since that auspicious beginning, biological knowledge has increased by leaps and bounds. The most profound insight of modern science is that life is based literally on machines, machines made of molecules. Much like for the alien half-humanoid, half-machine Borg in Star Trek, tiny nanomachines perform the necessary tasks of cells. Among their many roles, machines and cells act as taxis and trucks, shuttling passengers and supplies across vast distances, relative to the size of the molecules, along cellular highways marked by traffic signs, both also made of molecules. Cellular computer programs of bewildering sophistication control the assembly of the machinery. Elegant genetic regulatory networks express the information in DNA to produce the right molecules at the right times in the right places, building the intricate bodies of animals. What scientists of earlier times took to be a primitive abacus has turned out to be a futuristic supercomputer. What biologists of Darwin's day thought was a quote, simple little lump of albuminous combination of carbon, close quote, that is the cell, pretty much just a microscopic piece of jello, has turned out to be a fully automated, nanoscale factory, sophisticated beyond human understanding. And that's the problem for Darwin. The molecular foundation of life has turned out to be astoundingly, gobsmackingly sophisticated, elegant beyond words. It's not only that the information in life is stored in a genetic code, a feature that's strongly evocative of intelligence and the likes of which had never been anticipated by chemical principles. Rather, it's that the more researchers look, the more and more levels of codes, programs, and controls are found. But don't take my word for it. Listen to the prominent embryologists Michael Levine and Eric Davidson describe control systems, at the time newly discovered, that help coordinate animal development. Quote, "Gene regulatory networks, GRNs, are logic maps that state in detail the inputs into each cis-regulatory module, so that one can see how a given gene is fired off at a given time and place. The architecture reveals features that can never be appreciated at any other level of analysis, but that turn out to embody distinguishing and deeply significant properties of each control system. These properties are composed of linkages of multiple genes that together perform specific operations, such as positive feedback loops, which drive stable circuits of cell differentiation." And also read, then president of the National Academy of Sciences, Bruce Alberts, marveling about the completely unexpected molecular machinery of the cell. He wrote, "We have always underestimated cells. Undoubtedly, we still do today. But at least we are no longer as naive as when I was a graduate student in the 1960s. As it turns out, we can walk and we can talk because the chemistry that makes life possible is much more elaborate and sophisticated than anything we students had ever considered. Indeed, the entire cell can be viewed as a factory that contains an elaborate network of interlocking assembly lines, each of which is composed of a set of large protein machines. Why do we call the large protein assemblies that underlie cell function protein machines? Precisely because, like the machines invented by humans to deal efficiently with the macroscopic world, these protein assemblies contain highly coordinated moving parts. Sure, the details of life also show dents and scratches, just like a fine automobile will show dents and scratches after long service on the road. But as with a car, it's not the dents that require much explanation. It's the highly functional arrangement of parts that does. How could Darwin's clunky mechanism, one tiny random change at a time, each followed by a long, fitful, and uncertain period of natural selection, with no ability to anticipate future needs, account for the molecular marvels that modern biology had uncovered? Increasingly, the answer became it couldn't. The more science advanced and the more elegance and complexity was uncovered, the more biologists drifted away from Darwinism. New proposals have been offered about how the cell might engineer itself, or arise mysteriously from raw complexity, or how different kinds of cells might join forces. Yet, while each new idea usually can explain at least one area of biology reasonably well, none seem any better than Darwinism itself in accounting for the whole. So even as biologists continue at breakneck speed to discover how life actually works in the present, and despite cheerleaders in the popular press and aggressive proselytizers, origins science is in a funk. The question that Darwin was supposed to have answered, what is the reason for the unfolding of life, stands unanswered. Yet, for those willing to see, the solution is blazingly obvious. Whenever we come across quote-unquote logic maps in our everyday world, or quote-unquote a factory that contains an elaborate network of interlocking assembly lines, we immediately conclude that they were purposely put together. Such arrangements simply reek of design. And why, in such cases, do we confidently conclude design? Why, whenever we observe a purposeful arrangement of parts in our everyday world, such as, say, an ordinary mechanical mousetrap, why do we routinely conclude that intentional, intelligent design is the explanation? The reason is that only minds can have purposes. So the discovery of parts arranged for a purpose allows us to infer that other minds besides our own exist. Now that we have unexpectedly stumbled over such very personal arrangements at the very foundation of life, that is the cell, there is no reason to withhold an identical judgment. I first entered the fray with the 1996 publication of Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. As a biochemist, I had become quite disenchanted with the Darwinian theory I had been taught throughout my education, and had concluded that tweaks to the theory were woefully inadequate. Enough was enough. It was time to take the bull by the horns, to stop pussyfooting around, to wake up and smell the coffee. It was time, I decided, for science to acknowledge that pre-Darwinian biologists were right. Life had indeed been purposely, intelligently designed. Initial reactions in the scientific community to my first book were muted. In private, some scientists were intrigued. At the beginning, even a couple of semi-positive book reviews were published, and the idea was quite well received among the general public. But soon, criticisms came in force. Apparently, the popularity of the idea with the public increased to the point where the scientific community actually felt threatened and initiated political steps to fight it. Science organizations published official pamphlets denigrating the concept of design. Popular science magazines warned of the impending end of Western civilization. Governments, influenced more by science organizations than by parents, issued edicts against discussing design in schools. Even a committee of the Council of Europe condemned it. All that seemed a rather excessive reaction to me, especially since the idea, agree with it or not, is spectacularly obvious. Design was quite easy for biologists to spot before Darwin, based simply on plant and animal anatomy. And now that his once promising idea hasn't panned out, it should be exceedingly easy for biologists after Darwin to see design based on the elaborate molecular machinery of the cell. After all, accounting for the strong appearance of design in life was the triumph of Darwin's theory, we were frequently told. Random mutation and natural selection mimic design, we were oft assured. But now that Darwin is in decline, we are left with the overwhelming appearance of design in life and no realistically plausible theory to explain it. I followed Darwin's Black Box with The Edge of Evolution, The Search for the Limits of Darwinism, in 2007. And in 2019, I extended my case with Darwin Devolves, the new science about DNA that challenges evolution. Each book drew heavily upon recent advances in molecular biology and confirmed and deepened the conclusions I had come to in my first book. No matter whether new results and a new mechanical theory may come along in the future to explain what Darwin's theory couldn't, and I very much doubt that, the current state of our knowledge intellectually justifies a firm conclusion of the intelligent design of life. Each of the three books drew responses from places high and low, some civil, some not so much. These responses gave me the opportunity to further extend my analysis, clarify points, and rebut fresh objections. Or, as was often the case, find fresh illustrations to rebut old objections I had already addressed previously. The present book is a selection of my writings and talks over several action-packed, fun-filled decades in many battles over Darwinism and intelligent design. Although I hope that the reader will be persuaded about the merit of design, both by the force of the arguments in its favor and the weakness, in my view, of those against, the book offers more than that. In the back and forth, point-counterpoint of the arguments, it provides an insight into how people who think about these things reason. it vividly shows that even the smartest of scientists and intellectuals are human and fallible. We all are influenced by our own interests and priorities, come from our own peculiar backgrounds, hope for our own visions of the future. All of those factors enter into our reasoning. Nobody on Earth is the reincarnation of Mr. Spock, either singly or collectively. In an ideal world, this book would include all of my critics' articles as well as my responses. But that would have made for an unwieldy and expensive book, even if I could have gotten permission to reprint them all. However, many of their essays are freely available online. Wherever possible, I provide readers with the information needed to track down the written criticisms I am responding to. Since I initially wrote the essays in this book for audiences that hadn't read much on the subject, most of them can stand alone. For ones that could use a bit of background knowledge, I add explanatory comments as needed. In a few, I tweak the prose a bit to make it read more easily for this collection, or to make a point clearer. A few of the pieces were written for publications that edited them rather severely. Here I include the original unedited essays. A few were intended as letters to the editor of various science journals or newspapers, but were not published, either because they were refused or because they missed a deadline. The original publications ranged widely, from formal science journals to newspaper op-eds to popular magazines to blog posts. So since one has to write for the intended audience, the style and level of technical detail ranges widely too. Some are stiffly formal, others breezy. Some give an overview, others have lots of specifics. Some are longer, some shorter. Nonetheless, even in the technical articles, the gist of the argument is easy to follow.
That was Michael Behe reading the introduction to his newest book, A Mousetrap for Darwin, just released and available at Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. I'm sure you're going to want to purchase your copy as quickly as you can. Again, it's A Mousetrap for Darwin by Michael Behe. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.